I'm Eileen Bolger, and I'm a trauma surgeon, acute care surgeon at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm happy to co-moderate this session with Dr. Joshua Brokhammer, who is an associate professor of urology from the University of Kansas at Kansas City. I think we have an exciting lineup for you today of some pretty innovative speakers. We're going to talk about the vexing problem of necrotizing soft tissue infections, rare disease, but something that almost every surgeon will encounter in their career and can be very challenging to manage. So we're going to hear about some new and novel approaches to this disease and just to kind of stimulate thought. And after we have three talks from our experts, we're going to have some cases that I'm going to present to them and see if we could spark some discussion, and then we'll take all the questions at the end of the session. So, again, I welcome you and thank you for joining us this morning. I'm delighted to introduce to you our first speaker. Dr. Sharmila Desanaki is a professor of surgery and chair. It's advancing on its own.
Sorry. Are you giving my talk?
Yeah, I'm giving your talk as well. Dr. Sharmila Desanaki is a professor of surgery and chair of the Department of Surgery at Texas Tech in Lubbock. She's a dear friend of mine. We trained together and really excited to have her talk to us about novel approaches to necrotizing soft tissue infections. Welcome, Sharmila.
Thank you very much, Dr. Baldrin. When she says we trained together, what she actually means is she trained me. I just want to clarify that. I don't want anyone to have overly high expectations here for what I'm going to do. But I want to talk a little bit about some of the new things in NSTIs. And because it's a very broad topic to cover, I am definitely not going to talk about every major paper that's been written on the subject in the last 5 years, or we'd be here all day. And I also don't like to give heavy slides full of data and then say, oh, I'm sorry, there's so much data on the slide. So in lieu of that, if anyone wants more details, please email me or you can contact me on social media. I'll be happy to provide more information. I'm really going to stick to the highlights of each point during this morning. So here's how we're going to do this. On every slide when we discuss a topic, I'm going to have the left-hand side be what I consider old and the right-hand side be what is new. And I'm starting off with this picture of Hippocrates because NSTIs are really, really old. And in fact, he described them in really quite beautiful prose with the flesh falling off in vast quantities and sinews dissolving. And it's a very nice, vivid description of an NSTI. And so this was something that people recognized even before germ theory and they knew what caused this. There's descriptions of NSTIs. So let's start with the diagnosis. And I'm not going to talk a lot about history and physical exam because that has really not changed. NSTIs remain fairly difficult to diagnose. Some of them are very rapid. They happen in a few hours, it feels like. Others you'll have sort of an indolent course over weeks. Some will look just like a mild cellulitis, and others have these awful hemorrhagic bullae and skin necrosis, and it's really obvious, and they smell to high heaven, and nobody has any problem diagnosing it from across the room. So there's a wide variety of presentations clinically, and so I'm not going to go into that in whole detail because really it remains a clinical challenge. And so one of the things that's in the old column now is the Larynx score. So this was becoming very prominent when I was training, and it was originally described by Wong in 2003 in critical care medicine as a diagnostic tool. And most of you are probably familiar with this. It's got some key components. And for a long time was, I think, one of our standards. It had some criticisms because if you look at it, the CRP is highly weighted. Who in this room routinely gets a CRP on patients in the ER with a suspected infection? Yeah, that's what I thought. So that's one of the problems with it. It's highly weighted towards a lab value that none of us ever get. Most of the others come with our routine labs, but there's been some discussion about which ones are more valuable than others. And so over the years, there have been studies that are casting some doubt on the sensitivity and specificity of Larynx for diagnosis. What's also happened is there are some people trying to use it for prognosis, to predict amputations and mortality rates, and that really has not been proven. So this is a study that came out earlier this year in Annals that looked at the diagnostic accuracy of multiple modalities, including the Larynx score. And this is just one of several studies that have done this. I picked it because it was a very recent meta-analysis, and it included 23 studies. But I want you to look at this point. The larynx score over 6, which is a pretty standard threshold for people to use, only had a sensitivity of 68.2% with a specificity of 84.8%. That's really not that good. I haven't highlighted it because we're going to talk about CT later, but if you look at the sentence above the one I've just highlighted, you will see that CT scan actually had significantly better predictive value than the larynx score in this meta-analysis that was done pretty well. So my take-home message on this, and this is where I get to just do the this-is-what-I-do thing, is I use individual laboratory values in the context of the HMP, and the ones that I've chosen are listed there. So when I say a high white count, I don't mean 18, 19, but I mean that once your white count is above 25, I find that to be really quite predictive in our experience, at least. Those very high white counts do tend to correlate with either C. diff or NSTIs. The low sodium below 130 seems to be a pretty strong indicator, at least in our series. A high creatinine renal failure, I think, is a strong indicator. I always teach my residents that cellulitis and abscess really should not be giving you organ failure and septic shock. If the patient has those conditions, it's probably an NSTI. And then when I say high glucose, I don't mean 200-300s. I mean, if it's an established diabetic, often they'll present 450, 500 for their glucose. So these sort of sky-high values are, to me, a pretty good indicator that you're dealing with an NSTI, and it behooves further investigation. And the further investigation that I'm going to suggest is surgical exploration. I think all of us as surgeons really need a low threshold to explore these wounds. And very often this is the problem I see, that people are not being aggressive enough to just make a small incision, either under local at bedside or in the operating room, and explore for dishwater fluid or signs of necrosis. And so I think the real take-home is that just having a low larynx score does not rule out an NSTI. I want to talk about imaging, really. It's been a long time since anyone looked for gas on plain X-rays. MRIs were all the vogue about 5 to 10 years ago. Our orthopedic surgeons still will send people for MRIs of their legs and arms frequently to look for NSTIs. And it does work. If you look at the image there, that's a gadolinium-enhanced MRI. And you can see it really does show significant enhancement of affected areas. It also shows air. But CT has increasingly become the method of choice. It's more easily available, of course. I always think we should just have the scanner at the door to the ER so the patient wheels through it the way modern practice is going. And it really does show, as you can see in that image, the air at least quite well. And so this was another paper from this year that looked at this. There have been several. Dr. Velmahas' group from Boston has done some good work in this region. But again, I just picked a reasonably large study that was recent. And if you look, they showed even better results in the meta-analysis I just showed you, where they had 100% sensitivity and 98% specificity for CT scans. So really a very robust tool. I'm going to ask that you please use IV contrast, even if that creatinine is nudging up. We had the New England Journal study last year that really showed that contrast nephropathy was overdiagnosed and overrated as a risk. I do think the IV contrast helps a lot. If you have air, great, you don't need it. But if you don't have crepitus in the physical exam and you're really looking for the more subtle findings, such as tissue enhancement, you need that IV contrast. The main benefit of a CT is if none of these things listed there are present, it really does effectively rule out an NSTI, and then you can treat those patients for their cellulitis. Okay, so that's the diagnosis part. So we all know the mainstay of treatment is surgery. So what's new? So this is where I become a little Macbeth, and I really think we need to be bloody bold and resolute in surgery still. And one of my co-panelists is going to tell me why I'm being a dinosaur here, and there's better ways to do this, but I am still admittedly one of those people that puts the big surgical booties on because I expect this to be messy. I'll do a lot of blunt dissection. I find that actually reduces blood loss, but mostly it saves time, and it allows you to delineate the tissue planes when you're just ripping the tissue off exactly the way the bacteria did so that you can get all involved tissue, and I take it till definitely healthy tissue and then maybe a centimeter more because I really do believe that the fewer operations we do, the quicker we get source control in that first operation, the better our patients do. So Dr. Bulger was part of this large group from East that looked at the optimal timing. And I'm only going to quibble that they and many other wonderful groups that looked at this keep using 12 hours as their threshold for early debridement. And I would like to frankly see something that looks at 2 to 6 hours. And I'll tell you why. There is a smaller European study that actually showed that the mortality goes up if you operate below 2 hours and after 10 hours, but the sweet spot is 2 to 10. Now, that does go very well with the findings in this study that showed that the mortality rate was 14% if you got to it within 12 hours versus 26% if you waited longer. However, there is another paper that came out this year that also says that waiting more than 18 hours showed no difference in mortality. Again, a smaller study. So it's still being questioned. And so my take home on this is you do need to start resuscitating the patient if they come to you in shock. Because the caveat is the patient who comes to you sick in shock and organ failure is probably the one that everyone's rushing to the OR because then there's no delay in diagnosis, right? So those patients do need some resuscitation. As soon as you start the resuscitation, please take them to the OR. You don't need to wait for everything to be perfect. And please don't be trending lactates and doing things until you've started operating and actually getting source control. I do think sooner is better. It is very intuitive to me that, as with every other type of sepsis, the sooner we get source control, the better. And so my urge is to not say that you have a comfortable 12 hours, but try to get this as soon as possible. Many of us are now going towards models with full-time surgery capacity available. To me, this is a surgical emergency that warrants the surgeon coming in and doing the operation right then. Okay, so this is the area with the most new stuff, is microbiology, antibiotic treatment. So the old stuff is the type 1 and type 2. And one of my pet peeves, I have a lot of pet peeves, but one of my pet peeves is stupid classifications that do not add to anything in the diagnosis or treatment. We just do it so we can get a paper, and then we can torture trainees for the next 10 years asking them over these stupid classifications. The people that did this one, I'm really mad at, because they made type 1, you would think that what this is a division between monomicrobial and polymicrobial organisms. Well, the only logical thing would have been to make type 1 monomicrobial, right? One organism, type 1? No, they flipped it around. So I'm very glad to put that in the old bucket, and I would ask you all just stop using it. It's annoying. The reality, though, is that even if you're not going to classify it, there is so much diversity in STIs that I think we've been doing this wrong for a long time. Because if you look at the results that come out from Europe, for example, there's a Danish group that has done a lot of wonderful work in NSTIs. Almost all their organisms are staph and strep, and they have a predominance of monomicrobial infections. And if you read any paper from the United States, it'll tell you that polymicrobial infections are predominant, and they are in North America. If you read papers from China, Japan, and Turkey, the microbes are completely different. And so we have a clearly very region-specific disease that we're now treating in one bucket, and I think we need to acknowledge that. I think we're a little behind on that. Traditionally, we have used culture sensitivities, standard methods to guide therapy. But my group and others are increasingly looking at PCR sequencing technology for diagnosis. And I'm going to very briefly show you some results from our lab, where we have done now quite a lot of work on sequencing the microbiome of NSTIs. All right, so the first graph is a study where we compared NSTIs, patients who survived and non-survived, with abscess. Abscess was our control group, to try to see why the same organisms cause such different infections. So here's the thing. Aerobic organisms that you normally culture, they're the blue bar. And if you're having a hard time seeing the blue bar, it's because it's that tiny little bar way at the bottom. Those are the bugs you're culturing. That's how small a percentage those are. Look at the anaerobes and the facultative anaerobes, the green and the red. That's nearly all the organisms there. And these are organisms that do not grow on standard culture methods. And now I'd like to ask you to look at the difference in the NSTI deaths versus the abscesses versus the survivors. It's a straight line. The more anaerobes you have, the more likely you are to die. So I think we have been really overlooking one of the biggest causes of mortality in this disease. Data not shown here, but in this same series that we started looking at, we found that if you had Pseudomonas, your mortality was 30%. If you had Enterococcus, it was 50%. So there are clearly some organisms that have a disproportionate impact on mortality, and I'm concerned that we don't acknowledge that enough. And so one thing that I now do is routinely do very strong empiric anaerobic coverage from the get-go after this data. You must tailor to your local antibiogram because you need to know what organisms grow in your region. I live in the dry city of Lubbock. I have a lot of Pseudomonas. I do not have Acinetobacter, which I know Dr. Bulger's shop at Harborview does. They're more wet. And so you need to know your local flora and not just go on whatever study came out from wherever. And please, just from our data, which is in, submitted for publication right now, which should come out very shortly, I think Pseudomonas and Enterococcus need to be always considered. I'm sure you know Enterococcus is a common hole in antibiotic coverage. It's not covered by a lot of the broad-spectrum agents. Please be a little mindful. If your patient's not doing well, it may be because you're not covering Enterococcus. In wound care, a few new things. I just want to mention briefly two of them. Vacuum-assisted dressing is in both the old and the new columns because I think we are defining its role. It's been used for a while. I use it in clean wounds to get them ready for skin grafting or other reconstruction. It works very well. But what I've changed in the last 3 years is that I now leave all these wounds completely open to air and sometimes with heat lamps on them to dry them out. I make it the Sahara Desert. Goes against every wound care teaching that there is. And I do this after the first operation for 48 hours till I'm happy that the source control is done. And it's, again, based on basic principles. I love basic principles. We know these organisms thrive under the skin. They want to be anaerobic. So then we fillet them open, and then we cover it up with a bunch of gauze, and I don't understand that. So I said, okay, we're going to stop doing it. And initially, there was a lot of resistance, as you might imagine. Oh, my God, the patient's not going to tolerate it. It's going to hurt so badly. The family won't tolerate it. So here's what's interesting about that. So this is the paper we published this year on that. And we did 96 patients, so not a huge study, but for NSDI, it's not a terrible one either. And our pain scores were actually lower in patients who were open to air. Now, if you look, our burn center does a great job of pain anyway. Oops, sorry. Because the average pain score ranges between 1 and 2. So we're doing a good job no matter what. But what was interesting is the nurses gave the patients who were open more drugs because I think it looked worse. But even once we adjusted and we had to do a lot of complex adjustment for morphine equivalents, the patients who were open had less pain. And it makes sense because you're not ripping Curlix off the raw wound several times a day. You don't have to take them back to the OR to see if the wound is progressing because you can examine them at bedside. And so we find that if we leave them open 48 hours, we have, if we do have to go back to the OR, we go back quicker because the nurse will call going, okay, I can see some liquid coming out. Oh, the redness is spreading. And we go straight to the OR. So we are really loving this. It's now become our form. And so I'm hoping I won't have a comparison group, but in a few years to publish a larger series because we also saw a mortality benefit. It actually dropped from 7% to 4% in the open-to-air group, but the number was too small to show statistical significance. And so I'm hoping that with a little more data, and I'm hoping with a multi-center trial at some point, to show that leaving your wounds completely open, we spritz it with some lubricant if there's tendons and things involved, but if you leave it open, I think it does better for those patients. And then I'm going to just finish by talking about some adjunct therapies. So here's a list of adjuncts. Hyperbaric oxygen has been a treatment looking for a disease for many, many decades, and I do think it has some use in the reconstructive phase of wound healing, but NSTIs, it has been looked at. There's actually quite a lot of studies on that. Intravenous immunoglobulin has been looked at some centers, plasma exchange, and then some immunologic treatments have also been looked at. And so, I'm sorry, I've got a little slide problem here. So this is a study that came out from Harborview that looked at therapeutic plasma exchange. Immunoglobulin here was a large randomized trial, the INSTINCT trial. This was done from the Danish group. And this is the one that looked at AB103. And the short version is that none of them actually seem to help much. So it'll save you some time to say that all of these are options, but the data is really not convincing that they help a lot. So we're really back to good old-fashioned surgical care and antibiotics. They're not rare diseases anymore, and I'm thrilled to see so many of you in this room in the very last session. They're really quite frequent. And so while the basics of treatment are still the same, there's been a little bit of nuance and some evolution. And because we have so few evidence-based recommendations, I would encourage everyone to pool our data. And I think it's a great field to continue research. Thank you.